So, a number of years ago, I was in Israel, and I was given a tour of the old city of Jerusalem. And the fascinating thing about the tour of the old city of Jerusalem, or tours in general, but specifically about the old city, is you really think you've seen it all, right? You walk in the old city, you think you know every nook and cranny, and you have not the faintest idea how much is going on right underneath your nose. So, for instance, just as an example, when you go to Shaar Yafo, the next time you go to the old city, when you walk out, you know there's two entrances. There's the walking part, and then they broke through the wall so you can drive through. You go to the right-hand side of the area where you drive through, there's actually a statue, which is right there, but most people have no idea, between a crusader and one of the Muslims defending the city, fighting a massive statue. Right, and you just drive past it. Most people don't realize that there's a statue there. A lot of interesting history there. But if you go into the gates of Shaar Yafo, so if we're sort of picturing this in our minds, as you enter into the old city through Shaar Yafo, and you turn to your left, your immediate left. So I was with a whole group of guys from Yeshiva. We all walk into the old city. And what happens is, there's Arab stores all the way along the left. And then ahead of you, straight ahead of you, is the Shuk. Right? And then we usually turn to the right to go past Migdal David through the Armenian Quarter. Right? But immediately to your left as you come in, there's one store. There's a gap between the stores, and the stores continue. So our tour guide beckons us over. We look between the gap of the two stores, and there in that area is this little picture over here. So this is what's there. So he says, "Do you know what that is?" So everybody's trying to work out what exactly it is that picture. And he says, "That is the tomb of." There's actually two of them right next to each other, of the two architects of the walls of the old city, because when the Sultan had finished them, the way it works in those days is he says, do it, and they do it, but he didn't like the end result. So he killed them immediately after they finished the job. But he gave them a special seat, right? So the next time you go to the old city, take a look. It's immediately to your left as you get into Shaar Yafo, and you'll find the Ottoman architects of the old city, right? May they rest in the pieces left, right? And so immediately at this point in time, all the Kohanim in our group jumped backwards. Right? Because you can't really see from this picture, but in this little area are two tombs and a tree. So all the Kohanim jumped backwards because they were concerned that they were in the same vicinity under a tree from a grave. What I'd like to do in the next little bit is to explore the halachas that relate to that. Because the last time I checked, these two wonderful gentlemen were not Jewish. And the question really becomes, is there an issue of Tumah, of impurity, when it comes to non-Jewish graves, non-Jewish cemeteries? How does that relate to us on a halachic level? And to try to unpack that on a hashkafic level. So we're going to work through this sequentially, slowly, methodically. There's a lot of there's complex issues, and there's a lot to think about over here. Before going further, Ari, nothing to talk about yet. No observations. Okay. Let's get a little bit of a little traction first. Okay. This is the issue to discuss. So, let's move into the first place to start. The first place, this is mentioned, is a Gemara in Yavamos. Here's how the Gemara goes. Again, we're going to work through this very slowly, very sequentially, very methodically. There's a lot ahead of us. The Gemara tells us the following. Tanya, there is a taught in a Braisa. A Braisa is always a Tanatic teaching. So we're talking about people living at the times of the Mishnah. V'chein hoya Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai Omer. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai would say, "Kivrei ovdei kochavim einon metamim ba'oihel." The graves of non-Jews, of ovdei kochavim, those who worship the stars, do not render impurity through an oihel. How does an oihel operate? Just to clear, so we're all on the same page. So there's different ways of tumah being transferred from one entity to another. Most obvious one is if you touch it. Immediate contact. So that's called maga. Then there's masa, which means you're carrying it, even if you may not be touching it. Heset, if you're moving it, even if you're not carrying it or touching it. There are different degrees of how you can transfer tumah, and they apply themselves differently. The one thing which is only applicable to human beings is what's called tumas oihel. Oihel means to say, there's three options of what an oihel could mean. One is that let's say there is a corpse, or a piece of a corpse, for that matter, and you happen to walk over it, right? So you are mahil, you are in a certain sense standing over it, you become tamei, or vice versa. Let's say for whatever reason, I'm trying to imagine the circumstances, you walk underneath the corpse of a human being, that the corpse itself is mahil, is a tent over you. Similarly, these are less known circumstances because these are more, they're less frequent. The most common one we know is, of course, if there's a single canopy which covers both the mace, the corpse, and you, and then we say that there's what's called tumas oil, and the tumas spreads throughout underneath that entire canopy, and the person becomes tameh. So says Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, that is not true by a non-Jewish corpse. That's the halacha. Why? He says shene'emar, as it says in the pasuk, quoting the pasuk in Yechezkel, va'ten tzon mar. You see, you are my flock, adam atem. You are considered a human. You are considered an adam, a person. Now, what does that mean? Atem kruyim adam, ve'ein ha'avde kachavim kruyim adam. You are called, we're called, in inverted commas, Adam, or humanity, and the non-Jews are not considered a humanity in this respect. Now, what does that mean exactly? How's that helping us? Okay, so it happens to be, this is why it's related to Parshas Chukas. The beginning of Parshas Chukas is talking about purity and impurity, and it says, the Torah says, Adam ki yamus ba'ohel. When a person will die in a tent, kol asher ba'ohel, everything in the tent becomes impure. Now, the defining term for that which renders everything else in the tent impure is the word Adam. So what the God Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is saying is, if you look in Yechezkel, who is in the, we'll call it in that catch group called Adam? Only Jews, because Atem Kriyam Adam, you are called Adam. That excludes a non-Jew who does not have the possibility of making everything in the tent impure. That's what Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says, and therefore, based on that principle, if we just think about it at this point in time, if that's true, should there be an issue of entering into a non-Jew cemetery? Answer is no, because generally speaking, in a cemetery, you're not touching anything, right? The only concern is ohel, is that the tumah goes up from all the graves, and by the way, there's no limitation to it; it goes all the way up to the heavens. So if you're walking above those graves, you are in a certain sense mahil on them, right? They are underneath you, and the tumah hits you. Now, that applies itself not to the regular Joes, but to the Kohanim, who have an isser, have a prohibition of becoming impure. So it would be an issue of entering a non-Jewish cemetery. But it says Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, no problem. Why? They don't have this disclaimer called tumas oil. Oh, great question. How excluded are the non-Jews from Tumah, from Hilchos Tumah? By the way, I know there might be some questions in the back of our mind, you know, humanity, who's humans, why Tumah? So hold on to those. We're going to have a chance to deal with these in a much deeper level at the end. I want to do Halacha first, Hashkafa second. So just to appreciate this, because there's a very, very fascinating background over here. Let's go a little further. The Gemara asks a few questions where you see places in Tanakh. The Gemara, as an example, it says, when you're going to conquer Midian in Parshas Matos, we're coming up on that in a few weeks, it says there's going to be 16,000 souls who they kill, and it uses the word Adam to describe the Midianites, who are generally speaking not Jews. Right, so the Gemara says, no, it's referring to Adam there in relationship to Behemoth, meaning to say humans versus animals, not Adam versus Jews. Okay, so the Gemara has a few backwards and forwards. At the end, the Gemara says a very interesting thing. Here, let's take a look at this, the continuation of the Gemara. Towards the middle of the Gemara, there's a little four, which is a footnote, and it's three lines, three words from the end of the line. Towards the middle of the Gemara, it says, "Kol horeg nefesh." So this is by Midian, where the Jews are attacking Midian, who sent this delegation of their young ladies that came in to Baal Peor and seduced Bnei Yisrael. This whole episode, this is the response to this, is the war on Midian. So the Torah tells us, "Kol horeg nefesh, kol nageh b'chalal tischatau." Anybody who killed, any of the soldiers who killed, needs to have the purification process. Wait a second, they just killed non-Jews, right? So why is there a requirement of purifying the 7 days through the Paradumah? So Gemara says, Dilma iktul chad mi Yisrael. Maybe it's because the concern is that there were Jewish casualties in the battle, and they came in contact with the Jewish casualties. That's the concern the Gemara says. The Rabbanon, the rabbis who argue on Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, said no. The Torah says there were no casualties. There were no Jews who died. It was only non-Jews, and therefore, if you have to purify yourselves, it means that you become tamei through being involved with a non-Jewish corpse. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, lo nifka mimenu ish la'aveira. What does it mean that nobody was lost? It doesn't mean that nobody died. There were Jews who died, but nobody went wayward in this battle. Nobody made mistakes, moral mistakes, when it came to this battle. So they have two different ways of reading it. Well, the reason why this part of the Gemara is important is you see that Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is not the only person on this playing field. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai feels that non-Jews are not metame ba'oil, and it sounds like the Chachamim, the Rabbanon, do. So there's an argument by implication over here between Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai and the rabbis. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is more mekil to say there's no tumah by Ovdei Kochavim, whereas the Rabbanon say there is. That's what we see from this Gemara. What do you say to halacha? Ravina Omar, Ravina is a later day Amora, so a few hundred years later, says, third last line, Nehi dema'atinu kra mi'it muyeh ba'ohel. It is true they are excluded from tumas ohel, tumah which is transferred via a canopy. However, Jasib Adam Kiyomus Boel, because the pasuk in Parashas Chukah says, when an Adam will die in a tent, Mimaga umimasa mimatinukra. They aren't precluded from touching. In battle, they're not throwing tents over each other. They're killing each other with swords, right? So at this point in time, there's obviously contact. If there's contact, of course they're becoming Tomei, which is why the Torah talks about it. So Ravina's way of addressing, Barbara, your question now. So according to the way the Gemara seems to conclude, touching or moving a non-Jewish corpse certainly does render Tuma, but being under the same oil does not. That's what seems to be. For all intents and purposes, when it comes to graveyards, it's okay. We are still all right. Right? Because generally speaking, you're not supposed to be exhuming anybody. Right? So at this point in time, we should be sufficiently all right from a halachic perspective. This is the basis of our discussion. Of course, it is a little more complex because there are a few more factors. So I want to just deal with some of those factors and let's try to sort of see how the halachic process works. We're going to follow through this is a very classic way of the development of halacha. So before getting to further halacha, the Gemara actually tells us the following story. This is a Gemara about Messiah Daf Kuf Yud Dalet Amud Beis. The Gemara tells us the following. We're not doing the whole thing, but it's actually the framework of the story. Sometimes it's important not to just focus on the facts, but the context of the facts in order to be able to see the halacha. So he has an example of that. The Gemara says, towards the end of the first line, Ashkeche Rabba Bar Avua Le'eliyahu Dekoi Beveis HaKfaros Shel Avdei Kochavim. Rabba Bar Avua came and he wanted to have a conversation with Eliyahu HaNavi, and he found Eliyahu HaNavi was waiting in a non-Jewish cemetery. And he asks him a complex halachic question, which relates to the Gemara in Bava Metzia there, which relates to Erechin, which relates to certain payments. And he asks the question, and when he finishes this whole discussion, he turns to Eliyahu and he says the following question. You see there's a little line in the middle, that's the overlap of page Kuf Yud Dalet Amud Aleph to Amud Beis. The second of the line from that, in towards the middle of the line, says Amale Lav Koyen Humar, my time a Koy Mar Beveis Akvaros. Sorry, I just wanted to work out. Aren't you a Koyen? How can you be standing in a non-Jewish cemetery? Why is Eliyahu a Koyen potentially? Okay, so according to the opinion that he is the extension of the soul, or maybe even the person of Pinchas. Pinchas, of course, was somebody who got kahuna. And therefore, if he has kahuna, and the Gemara is assuming that Pinchas has something of priesthood in his veins, that means to say, or in his soul more likely, that means to say that how could you be standing in the non-Jewish cemetery? So the framework of the story is what's significant to us, and he responds, Amalei, loy masni mar taharos. Eliyahu says, you didn't learn meseches taharos, you didn't learn seder taharos. So isn't it explicit there? That Tanya in the Brayos, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai Omer, Kivreim shel Avdei Kochavim ein metamim, that the graves of non-Jews are not metame. Shenemar v'atem tzani tzan marisem, marisi odom atem kriyam odom v'ein Avdei Kochavim kriyam odom. That the only person who's under the definition of the word odom is Jews, and therefore there's no tumas ohel by the non-Jews, and that's the response Eliyahu gives to him, and he explains that he only learned four of the Siddurim, which were relevant to the time, not Seder Taharos. He said he was still struggling with the four parts. Remember that all of Judaism is divided into six categories, right? And they are, that's what we call Shas, Shisha Sedarim, right? So he said, I'm working on the four. I haven't got to the other two yet. And Eliyahu's a very interesting conversation. He says he's impoverished, which is why he has difficulty. And Eliyahu, there's a very interesting story, takes him to Gan Eden and puts a certain smell in his shirt, which he's able to sell. Anyway, it's a very interesting continuation. But nonetheless, for all intents and purposes, it seems that Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai's opinion seems to be upheld elsewhere. The reason this is important is because we've seen that the Gemara in Yevamos seems to indicate that there's a dispute. There's the Rabbanon and Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai as to whether there is Tumah which is rendered through a non-Jewish corpse. When it seems that Eliyahu is responding, Eliyahu is quoting only Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai as an indicator that we are Mekel Lahalach. We allowed that there's no Tumah which is transferred when it comes to a non-Jewish corpse, when it comes to at least Tumas Ohel, Tumah transfer to a canopy. That's what we seem to see from this Gemara, from the story. By the way, this is one of the examples of how halacha works, is that through the way a later day story is related, we see which of the opinions seems to be predominant. Okay, so this is the Gemara. We haven't gone further than the Gemara. So when we move to the halachic process, the next stop on the train is usually the medieval commentators. We go through what we call the Rishonim, the earlier commentators. They did not call themselves the Rishonim. It's one of these funny things, right? When do you become part of the stage, you know? It's always the people outside the stage. Like, who called the millennials, right? Generation X, baby. Like, when did this happen? So it's usually at the end of the stage, right? So the Rishonim is a period which runs approximately from the year 1100 to the year 1500, around the times of the Shulchan Aruch. Anybody with that catchment is usually called a Rishon. So Rashi, Rambam, you know, all the predominant Rishonim fall into this phrase. It's a huge proliferation in Torah. So what do they say about this? There happens to be three tiers of how halacha could fall out. So we're going to go through three sort of different tracks, see the perspectives and see how they are congregated in halachic formulation. The first is the Tosfos Academy, which is an academy established by the children and grandchildren of Rashi in northern France, and they had this very interesting method of study in which they would give different sections of the Beis Medrash different areas to find expertise in, and they would use their sum total brain power to in a certain sense aggregate halacha and aggregate all the Gemaras, and that's why Tosfos is usually quoting other Gemaras against the Gemara you're reading in order to be able to sort of synthesize those two ideas. So here's what the Tosfos says in source 3. We're not going to read the whole Tosfos. Don't worry, the Tosfos is starting on the second line in the Tosfos. There's an abbreviation which goes Vav Aleph Resh Yud, which is V'Omer Ri. Ri was the Ri HaZaken, was one of the elders of the Tosfos, and he says the following, V'Omer Ri, De'ein Halacha Karebi Shimon. We do not paskin like Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. Meaning we're not mekil to allow a kohen to walk into a non-Jewish cemetery. Why don't we? He says, De Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, polig ole. There is a machlokes which is found by Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel against him. As he says in Ohalos, v'halocha kamoisoi b'mishnasenu. That we know that we paskin like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel over anybody else. And therefore, v'tzrichim kohanim nizayim mikivrei avdei kochavim. That's why we would say that kohanim need to be very careful about going over graves of non-Jews. What is Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel saying? What is his statement? So if I just reference the mission itself, which he is quoting, if you look in source 4, it's a bit of an oblique reference. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel oimer, ir goyim shecharva ein ba mishum medar goyim. That if you have a non-Jewish city which has been destroyed, you don't have to worry about the graves in that city. Why? We don't have to worry about a kohen, let's say, walking over the ruins. Why not? So the Bar Tanura, Rabbi Avadia Bar Tanura, in explaining this Mishnah says, because we assume that at the time it was destroyed, the wild animals came into the city, and there are no longer left any corpses, right? There's no longer any semblance of corpses that were left because when there was utter destruction of this nature, we assume that there was no burial left for the people in the city. That's the assumption over here. Implications being, if it would have been under normal circumstances, if you were to come into a regular city which had not been decimated, and there were graves, then the Kohanim would have to be more careful. That's the implication. It sounds like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel disagrees with the principle of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. That's what it sounds like. Now, why would it be that Rabbi Shimon bar Gamliel has precedence over Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai just out of interest, just for just halachic interest? Rabbi Shimon bar Gamliel is the Nasi. He is from the Davidic line. He's from the generations of Hillel. He was reestablished as the Nasi. So what he says is of great significance when it comes to this. There are rules about how Psak works. So if you're Rabbi Shimon Gamliel arguing with a Yachid, with another individual in one Mishnah, he is always, almost always, the one who comes out on top when it comes to the halachic process. Okay, so says the Tosas, it's true, it's all right to read the Gemara Mabitsiah and the Gemara Yevamos and think that's the be-all and end-all, but you have to read the Mishnah in Aalos to see the reference. You see this? Meaning like, to be able to see the bigger picture. That's what Tosas suggests. Therefore, Kohanim, be very careful about entering into non-Jewish cemeteries. That's what Tosas suggests, amalgamating the Mishas together. However, that's not the last word on the page. That we'll call opinion extreme opinion number one. Meaning to say, all non-Jews have Tumah, even Tumas oil, according to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. That's why Tosas, Paskins, that's what the practice was in northern France. However, the Hagos Mamonios, this is a commentary which is found on the Rambam himself. Maimon is the Rambam. So Hagos, on the notes on the Rambam, says the following, quoting the Yir'aim in Saw 6. V'chein kosa b'sefer Yir'aim, the Sefer Yir'aim, the Ra'aim, which is Rav Eliyahu Mizrahi, who we're more familiar with his commentary on Chumash. When you look at the Chumash in the Melot of Mikras Kedoshim, you have the Mizrahi, right? So that refers to the Ra'aim. The Ra'aim also has a halachic commentary, and he says the following. Takaim alon kerishimim b'yochai, me'acha shel yauzal, osa ma'isa k'moisa. He says, well, you may have Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, but I have Eliyahu Anavi. Right? Eliyahu Anavi allowed himself to walk into the cemetery based on Rabbi Shimon b'yochai. So what better could you get than that? Right? Nonetheless, listen to this. Polig Olei Bachada, he disagrees with Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, and he says, Shekosav, Kavon de Loi Metame Ba'oil, Bamaga Uvamasa Nami Loi Metamu. He goes on to quote a Sifre, which is a halachic medrash, to be found in Sefer Vayikra, in Parshas Emor, to say that not only is a non-Jew not metame, does not render tumah through an oil, but also through indirect contact as well. He's much more makil even than Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, the Rashbi himself. That's how far he goes. So if you think about it over here as extremes, the Tosas say everything, right? We're worried about the tumah of non-Jews completely. The Mizrahi says, on the other side, there's no problem, there's no tumor whatsoever. The more of the medium approach over here is the Rambam himself. Maimonides, the Rambam says pretty clearly in Source 7, Echad hameis mi Yisrael oy akko metame b'mago of masa. Corpses of Jews or non-Jews alike render tumor, render impurity via direct contact or via carrying. However, in the next halacha he says, V'ein ha'akum, that means to say, ovdei kochavim, the non-Jews are not metame ba'ohel. This is a tradition that they're not transferred tumah through a oil, through a canopy. So the Rambam is kind of like the middle of the road, which sounds a little bit more like Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai himself was saying, whereas at the extremes, the Tosas is machmir, and the Yiraim is mekel. This is, by the way, a very classic framework, which is why it is a very useful sugya. You have the Gemara, you have the Rishonim split up into a tripartite division over here. What do you do la'alacha? So this is why we can appreciate the brilliance of what Rav Yosef Karo was doing. Rav Yosef Karo coming at the end of the year of the Rishonim noticed all this, and he saw these different tracks of opinion. And what it would actually mean is that in Spain and in Fustat, in Egypt, when you asked the halacha would be such. When you went to northern France and you asked the halacha would be such, which means that B'nai Yisrael was in a certain sense drifting into different traditions based on who the poskim were in their places. So the Shulchan Aruch did was, he congregated all the opinions and he says, this is the way we do things. Right? Now it helped in a lot of ways. Here's an example. So what the Shulchan Aruch says, this is in Hilchos Avelos, the Shulchan Aruch Paskins in Source 8, Kivrei Ode Kochavim Nochon Lizayir Akoyen Milelech Aleihem. A person should not walk over, a Kohen should be careful not to walk over non-Jewish graves. And who's he quote? The quotation in the brackets is, you see the Maharam and Tosfos. Right, we saw that Tosfos. That Tosfos appears in two places in Shas. We saw one of the places it appears. So he is paskening le chumra. However, the Ramo, Rav Moshe Isserles, who's doing the same thing as the Shulchan Aruch, he just lives in Europe. So Ashkenazi Psak flows through the Ramo. He says in his note, here we go, he says, Af Alpi in the parentheses, Af Alpi, that's the abbreviation, Shiesh Mikilim, even though there are those who are Mekil, those who are lenient, in parentheses, who's that? The Rambam, as we just saw, and the Haggois Mamonius B'Shem HaYireim, Nachon Lachmir. It is better to be machmir. And then he says an interesting thing. He says, if you have a Jew who rejected their Judaism, he says, you still treat them they have hilchos tumah, and it's a problem to walk over their graves. Very interesting discussion. Meaning, everybody would agree that a mumar, a Jew who has rejected their Judaism, or some part of their Judaism, it still has hilchos tumah when it comes to this. So what is the bottom line over here, just to appreciate what's happening over here in the framework of halacha? The Shulchan Aruch, the Sephardim, Rav Yosef Kara is paskant, lechumra explicitly, we passing like Toysos. What is the Ramo really paskening like? The Ramo, the Ashkenazi Psak says, really, 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 be'etzem, meaning to say like foundationally, really it should be the Rambam. But nochoin, it is better to be machmir. It's nochoin yizahir, to be careful. That's the way the Ashkenazi Psak seems to work. Well, the funny thing about it is even, what was that? In a lot of cases, it's a suffix. Some cases, it's not a suffix. So it's interesting. This is what the Shulchan Aruch paskens. The question is that the Shulchan Aruch did help congregate the opinions, but it isn't always the end of the last word on the page. So as an example, just to follow this through, there is on the page, there's a pirish in the side column, very small pirish called the Dogul Mervava, which is, in fact, the Noida B'Yehuda. The Dogul Mervava, the Noida B'Yehuda, Cheskel Landau, one of the greatest poskim from Prague. He was the successor of the Maharal of Prague, a tremendous, tremendous poisek of note. When we look at the Noda B'Yehuda, we recognize him for two things, well, in terms of his writings. The one is his Noda B'Yehuda is his responsa, his tshuvos. Yehuda wasn't his name. His name was Rabbi Cheskel Landau. Yehuda was his father. So he called his sefer after his father. And he has another pirush on the Gemara, which isn't halacha. It's more just trying to expand the Gemara, which is called Tzlach, which is called Tzion Nefesh Chaya. Chaya was his mother. So his two books he wrote was his father's name and his mother's name. And he has a pirush on Shulchan Aruch called the Dogul Merivava. And he says the following, very interesting thing. We're not going to read it inside, but he says a very interesting halachic note. This is post-Shulchan Aruch, right? This is much later. He says a very interesting suggestion. This is the last piece of the halacha. And that is that there is a rivet, Rav Avram Av Beistin, who argues in the Rambam, and he says a very interesting thing. He says that maybe today, it's different. Why today would halacha over here apply differently about Tumas Kohanim than it would perhaps at the times of the Gemara?
They can't be Torah anyway.
So we assume today that everybody is in a state of impurity today. We assume that everybody's in a state of impurity. And the Ravid says that maybe when a Kohen is already in a state of impurity, going to further impurity may not be a problem. Now, do we paskin like this Ravid? Answer is no, because Jewish Kohanim do not enter into a Jewish cemetery. That's halacha, right? Unless it's for an immediate relative, right? Or there's a way to get in without going under trees or wide paths, right? It's complicated stuff. So we don't paskin like the Ravid. But says, what was that Kohen friendly? There's a few Kohen friendly because as the they fill up, right? So what's interesting is. Is says the Noda B'Yehuda, it is true that we don't paskin like that Ravid, but the Ravid constitutes what we're going to call a Svek Sveka. Meaning to say, when you have two Svekos, two independent doubts, which are put together in Halacha, then maybe we can be Mekil. So are we Mekil? Meaning to say, do non-Jewish cemeteries or graves render Tumah? Well, that's a Machloikas. That's one Sofik in Halacha. Is there an issue for Kohanim to be metame themselves today? Well, that's also a machlokes between the Ravid and the Rambam. So putting those two svekos together, we get what's called a svek sveka. A svek sveka allows us to be more mekil in this particular case. That's what the Dogul Mervava suggests over here. And he says that at the end of this over here, just take a look at the very, very bottom of the left-hand column. He says the last three lines. He says, Noch lochein, Nira la anias daiti demi shiroitzel ismoich bazel hakel ein moichin biyada. A person who wants to be makel based on this We're not, no concern. He seems to retract himself in the next few lines, but nonetheless, this seems to be the way he passes. So let's get to the bottom line now. What is the actual halacha? So coming down to the very, very bottom line over here, we've seen the Shulchan Aruch had paskind l'chumra, like Tosfos. We saw the Ramah paskind that it is be'etzem, foundationally like the Rambam, where there's no Tumas Ohel, where there is a Tumah of Mago and Maso, but Nocho and the Hizoyer. So the Psak is Lahalocha. What do we do today? The Psak is Nocho and the Hizoyer. That means to say, in a situation where there is options, where there are other ways to go around it, then it is better to avoid it. It's Nocho and Hizoyer. It's better to avoid it. However, there's certain circumstances in which it's not possible to. So, for instance, Kohanim, who needs to go into hospitals for occasion, or let's say Kohanim are going through medical school, completely separate shaila for other reasons, not just for non-Jewish corpses, but for Jewish corpses, but for on the sake of this, then the entering the hospital is not, there's no longer a concern with Paskin, but Yevet like the Rambam. If there's no other way to drive along the street, there's no alternative routes are further away, then in that case, it's Nocho and Hizoyer, it's better to avoid. So for example, in Chicago, where we used to live, there were three parallel roads which led from the West Rogers Park neighborhood to the Skokie, the yeshiva in Skokie. There was Pratt, Tui, and Devon. And Pratt would run in one direction, would run towards the Skokie yeshiva. It was covered by trees in a non-Jewish cemetery. And so Kohanim would try not to use that route. Why? Because there were other roads. There were equally easily accessible roads. You could go along the other two roads to be able to get to the Skokie yeshiva. So it was Nochoin Lehizayir. It was better to avoid. So in general speaking, the Kohanim will avoid this, but nonetheless, one can be makel. I know that I was speaking to Rav Feigenbaum, who mentioned that when he was in Memphis, he spoke to Rav Nachman Greenblatt, who also said we can be makel in circumstances of need. So to Rav Talavam also said we're makel, certainly in a hospital where it's a sofek, when we don't know that in this particular case, it is. Interesting case. Yossi Simpson mentioned to me that when he was in medical school, they would do that. It was the night before their examination. When they were going through the autopsies, the bodies that they'd spent all year working along on, the cadavers they'd worked all year on, and they went the night before to be able to actually just check out things the night before, because the way the exam would work would be that they would have to go through, there were 50 cadavers, and each cadaver had little flags on it, or little labels on various different limbs or on various different organs or nerves that had to be identified, and that's how you would go through. Each cadaver was worth 2 points. And they went through the night before, and they came along, and they found that the cadaver, they'd worked on one cadaver the whole year. They went along, and they found another few cadavers, 4 cadavers, which were, in fact, had bracelets from the Jewish home, and had names, the names of the people, had been Jewish people. So what the question was, that the other 2 people working in their group were people who were, in fact, Kohanim, but not religious, they weren't observant. And the question was, is twofold. What do you do? So on the one hand, you're getting Hana'ah from the Nivul HaMeis. On the other hand, is also the Kohanim coming into not just non-Jews who are corpses or cadavers, but Jewish corpses. So what do you do? So he explained that he called up Rav Kornmel, who is the founding Rav of this shul, the young Israel of Lawrence Cedarhurst. This is 12 o'clock at night, and said, well, what do we do? So he said, regarding the clearly evidently Jewish cadavers, in that particular case, you cannot get Hana from them. You cannot identify on those particular cadavers. So automatically they lost, I think it was 8 points because it was 2 per cadaver, and they were not able to go forward in that. But regarding the Kohanim, he says, will they listen to you if they don't, if they tell you? And the answer is they probably wouldn't. So much of you are shogging by you mazidim. It's better that they do it in a state of unawareness. But nonetheless, that's just an interesting shayla that happens related to our particular shul, which Yossi mentioned to me. But nonetheless, in terms of the actual, when it comes to non-Jewish corpses, Nocho and Hizoyer, in certain circumstances, and there are many circumstances where it's not possible, we rely back on the Rambam, like the Ramah for Ashkenazim.
And by the way, Yossi, so it's interesting that in YU, the story goes that in First Hall, which is like, you know, the main building where the classrooms are, they said, I believe that there was a museum that was housed there for a while, and they had a skull of as part of this museum. That's a bit of a problem. So if you're a Kohen going to regular class, that's an oil, right? It's the same building. It's underneath it. So Rav Soloveitchik was makel based on this. Regarding entering First Hall as an example. So this is where it comes up. I want to actually, yes, John.
The point of not of Rabbi Yehuda, he gets it straight from the Mishnah Berurah. He says, he doesn't say a it's usher or anything. It just says nachon lizacher. He leaves a lot of room in the table.
Correct. Correct. There's a nachon lizacher is just to appreciate the different halachic terminology. Right? So he is saying foundationally it's mutar, but it's better to be machmir. So if it's better to be machmir, it's better to be machmir. But there's certain circumstances which are unavoidable. Dr. Honeyman, yes, has another coin, yeah.
Goyim are buried in coffins, and doesn't the top of the coffin have the
fantastic. So Dr. Honeyman is bringing up is another point over here, which is actually brought into the debate, and the suggestion is the following. It says, remember the Mahagoyis Mamonios, quoted the Yireim, who's very, very makil, right? He says that, you know, no problem with mago, no problem with oil. So in the continuation of his words, he says, one second, let me just see if I get this right. Oh, no, other way around. Tosfos, who is very, very machmir, Tosfos has said that we pass like Roshim and Gamaliel, that all goyim are metame, that all non-Jews are metame. So he says that why was Eliyahu sitting in the Beis HaKvaros? How could Eliyahu be doing that? Eliyahu is a responsible halachic observer, right? So what was Eliyahu doing? So he says maybe the reason why Eliyahu was reading the Beis HaKvaros was because he thought, he believed that in that particular grave, in that particular cemetery, they were buried in such a way that there was a halal tefach, which means to say that between the corpse, between the body and the actual coffin itself, there was a gap of at least a tefach, which creates its own oil. And the halacha is that when you create your own oil, that's mafsik, the tumah, and the tumah doesn't go any further up, which is how, by the way, kohanim fly on elal. Almost elal, every elal flat has a body on it, because if they're going to Israel for burial, how do you ever get onto that plane? That plane's in oil. So if you look at the next time one Rachman is on, we have to see that somebody's put into the there's a coffin, but in the coffin is placed into a special container box which has a chalal tefach, which has a gap in the middle, which creates the oil, which is mafsik oil, so we can now get on the plane.
Otherwise,
it's tumor ritzutza breaks up and is oil leshamayim. That's how we do it in general today, and that's for Jews. What was that? Yeah, for sure. I understand, but the LR ones are the more likely ones to have issues. So now, hashkafically speaking, I know this has been bothering all of us. Okay, just so like, I was kind of the elephant in the room. What exactly does that mean? That means to say that, you know, so non-Jews are chopped liver? Like, that's it? That's, inconsequential when it comes to how does that work? So some people say, yeah, well, that's the way it is. Now, but however, the Gemara itself seems to indicate that that's not the case. An example, I'll just give you one example, which is a famous example. The Gemara says in Source 10, that is the Gemara in Sanhedrin, after Nun Tes Amud Aleph, the general sugi over here about non-Jews and observance of mitzvahs. The quotes Rabbi Meir, Mesev Ehor Rabbi Meir Omer, Rabbi Meir would say, Minayin Shafilo Oved Kochavim V'Oisek B'Torah Shuk HaKoyen Gadol. How do you know that a non-Jew who abides by the Torah law and does everything, crosses all the T's, dots all the I's in their observance, is like a Kohen Gadol, the greatest, we'll call it, you know, the greatest apex of service of God, a person who enters Lifnai V'Lifnim, because it says, Asher Yosom Ha'adam, for Chai Bohem, now which a person will do, and live by them. Kohanim Levim Yisraelim Noi Ne'emar, it doesn't say only priests, Levites, and Israelites, it says, Elo Ha'adam, means human beings. A person who is like a non-Jew, who does their fair share of what they're supposed to do, which is the Shiva Mitzvah B'nai Noach, is like a Kohen Gadol because they reach their quota. Now, by the way, this is a revolutionary concept, because if you read the writings of of the Catholics and the Muslims, this is not the general way they view the rest of the world, just so you should appreciate this. In general, in the Muslim or Christian way of looking at the world, is that they will only arrive at penitence or the world to come if they see things our way, right? Right, or they die. So it's interesting that Judaism over here says, no, you don't need to convert to Judaism. Do what you do, serve God that way, and you can be 100% like our highest priest. That's a remarkable statement, right? Just appreciate how revolutionary this is. In the name of Rabbi Meir, a very different view of religion. I think the general way is that when you see a group of people who are defensive, it's a usual indication that they're not correct. Just an interesting. If you have to explain to the world why everybody has to be like you, it's a good sign that you're feeling very defensive about your system. Judaism isn't very defensive about their system. We know we have the truth, so let everybody. So I'm saying, like, you know, there's a place for every human being in it. We don't have to kill you. You don't have to kill us. And you can reach Olam Haba, we can reach Olam Haba, and there's different tracks. Mm-hmm. You don't have to convert for this to happen. Mm-hmm. Everybody's valued. But the problem is, what pasuk is he quoting? He quotes the pasuk, this is what you should do, Ha'adam. Didn't we just say that Adam is a limited term which refers only to Bnei Yisrael, according to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, quoting the Pasuk in Yechezkel? Right? Number one. Do you see a bit of a problem over here? That's number one. But it's more than that. The Mishnah Pirkei Avos. Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is the teacher of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Just to appreciate this. Okay? Rabbi Akiva is the Rebbe of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. So he Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is eating this breakfast cereal. Right, so this is what he says. What does he tell us? Who are your Omer? Rabbi Kiva would say in source 11, Perek Avos, Perek Gimel, Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tzelem. Dear is a human being who is created in the image of God. Chibu Yisera Nadas Lo Shenivra B'Tzelem. Greater dear is to them that they know that they're created in the Tzelem Elokim. Most people don't. Most people are not aware of that. Or don't act like they're aware of this. Is he referring to Jews or non-Jews? Everybody, all humans, because the next statement of the Mishnah is, how are Israel special? Because we are considered Chaviv in Yisrael Shenikru Bonim Namakom. We are considered children of Hashem. Right? That means to say, every single Adam, every single human being walking around is an image of God. They have the same capacity as a Jew. After all, Adam Harishon was not a Jew, right? Everybody was created but Selem Elohim, or every human being has that capacity. So how could it be that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is telling us that no, there's no Tumas Oil because they're not really considered Adam. They're not in that category. The Gemara seems to be pretty explicit about this, right? Number two is that Rabbi Akiva is saying, Adam Shnei Rabbi Tzelem. It's pretty explicit. So how do you square this in Hashkaf and in Halacha? Big question that's asked. There are lots of different ways of dealing with this. The Tosfos is actually on the page. In both these Gemaras, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Gemara in Yevamos, says, maybe there's a difference between, do you notice there's a slight difference between Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's Pasuk and the Pasuk quoted by Rabbi Meir? Do you notice? Ha-Adam. Right? So maybe it says, when it says Ha-Adam, it's inclusive. All of the humans. Right? When it says Adam, it refers to only Israel. It's very hard because there's exceptions to that rule. That's what the Rabbeinu Tam says, the grandson of Rashi. There's exceptions to the rule, but also, like, what does that mean? Like, meaning to say, we have to ask ourselves, what does Rabbeinu Tam really mean? Like, okay, so there's an extra letter. There's a Ha-Adam. It refers to all of humanity, the humans. And Adam refers to Jews. Like, what does it mean? It might be a linguistic, trick, but how does that help us? So let's dig this a little deeper. Okay, so just like to share two realms of thought together, if that's possible. Okay, one realm is spiritual and one is rational. So just from different eyes on the spectrum. The first, the spiritual side of things, is the Or HaChaim himself. Rachai bin Ibn Atta, one of the greatest Kabbalists who lived in the 1600s, moved to Eretz Yisrael, is buried on Har HaZeisim, and we had a chance to learn about him on Shavuos. If there's remarkable things, told about the Or HaChaim was a personality who shaped Jewish history in a remarkable way. The Baal Shem Tov actually lived at the latter years of the Or HaChaim, and talks about how when he realized on Shabbos when the Or HaChaim passed away, and he talked about how the light had dimmed in the world. Like, you know, when the Baal Shem Tov heard about the Or HaChaim passing, well, didn't hear, he sensed that the Or HaChaim had passed away. The crazy stories about what happens in the Or HaChaim's kever, we talked about this on Shavuos, and the desert campaign of Rommel as they're coming into Palestine in World War II, 1942, the Battle of Al Alamein, and who was praying at the kever of Or HaChaim HaKadosh, when the Jordanians were trying to destroy the graves to make the highway. The drivers kept dying as they came towards the kever of the Or HaChaim. Crazy stuff. The Or HaChaim HaKadosh is somebody, you know, I spoke about the Or HaChaim on Shavuos. Somebody came to me afterwards and said that they'd been married for 10 years, no children. They davened at the kever of Or HaChaim, and 2 weeks later, the couple were able to have a child. There's crazy stuff. If everybody has a chance to go to Har HaZeisim, one has to visit the kever of the Or HaChaim HaKadosh to daven by his kever. So this is what the Or HaChaim says on his Pirush on the Torah. He says the following. He says that the reason why the Torah starts in Parshas Chukas, it says Zois Chukas HaTorah. This is the law of the Torah. And what's it referring to when the Torah says that? What's it referring to? It's referring to Tumah and Taharah and Parah Adumah and how to cleanse oneself from direct proximity to Tumas Mace. So he asks a very basic question. That is like, meaning out of all the attributes, all the halachas which apply to human beings, why are you calling it Zois Toras? Well, this is the law of Zois Toras Adam. This is the law that refers to humanity. Like, meaning there's lots of other things, the halachas that apply to human beings. Why is Tumas so essential that it's got the title Torah? So says the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, a fascinating insight. He says the following. This is source 13. Uposko Rama Perak Aleph Milchos Tuma. Masha'ein Hakuti Nase Tomei Meis. He says an interesting thing. This is not the halacha we learned. But a non-Jew is not susceptible to Tomas Meis. That means a non-Jew can't become Tomei via contact with a dead body. Not like we were talking before, where we're coming into contact with a dead non-Jew, but vice versa. A non-Jew who comes into contact with Tumas Meis does not become Tomei. Why? This is what the Rambam explains. Shim Noga b'meis oy nosoy oy heil olav hareyu k'moy shel noga. A non-Jew comes in contact with death, is not susceptible to Tumas in the same way that we are. He says, it's almost like a animal. Now, he's not saying this to make an equation, but he's saying in terms of the halacha, there was no transfer of tumah. Ad kan. Vihine. Why is that? Hahevdil sheboy hurmu humru im b'nei Yisrael mishara goyim hu be'emtsaus kabbalas haTorah. Why are we different? Why do we receive tumah and the non-Jews don't receive tumah in the same way? Because we were given a certain mission, which is encapsulated in the Torah. Shezulas ze, without this, hinei kechol agoyim beis Israel. Without the Torah, we are simply another nation. Right? Umeato ta'amnu tzuf devash. Now that we tasted the taste of honey of the Torah, amri albama albama she'amar zois chukas ha'Torah, pirush chukazu shel tuma v'tnai Torah, so to sovev me'a Torah. Why is it that we are susceptible to the laws of purity and impurity in the first place is because we accepted the Torah. That makes us, that imbues us with a certain level of Kedusha, which means that therefore we receive Tumah and we also transfer Tumah. A non-Jew who didn't get this mission, didn't get this elevation then, doesn't receive Tumah in the same way and doesn't transmit Torah in the same way. It doesn't transmit Tumah in the same way. Why? Because of the Torah, which is why it's called Zois Torah Sa'adam. This is the law of you, of what it means to be a Jew, is because you are endowed with this mission. And that elevates you to a certain level. And therefore, it's a two-way street. So it's a function of our mission. It's a function of the Kedusha which is endowed in us. And this makes a lot of sense. This makes a lot of sense over here. This is not discriminatory. This is not saying that people are better or worse. This is our mission. And the mission comes with a number of provisos. When we sign the contract, In the fine print in note 43, that this is what it says. By accepting the Torah, this is what happens. You have to be a lot more careful about what you do, where you sit, what you walk under. Simple. Right? That's what the Rav Chaim says. However, I want to just move on, if that's all right, because just in terms of time, there's a remarkable idea which I found in the Tiferes Yisrael. Rabbi, the Tiferes Yisrael is, I feel, underrated. You know, now that Baruch Hashem, we have Kahati on the Mishnayos, and we have the Bartonor for many centuries, sometimes we overlook the Tiferes Yisrael. Tiferes Yisrael was Rabbi Yisrael ben Gedalia Lifshitz, who lived in Germany in the 1700s to the early 1800s. This is an important point because it was at this point in time, this was an age where there was a lot of scientific discovery. Germany, of course, was a very advanced nation. This is an age which is, this is sort of covering the Romantic period. Right? The Romantic period was the early 1800s, and this is reflected in his writings. It's very fascinating for a number of reasons. Let's take a look at how he suggests this. He first points out, just in terms of his questions, he says, it doesn't make sense. He's articulating kind of the discomfort that some of us may feel when learning the sugya. He says, under the section in 14 called questions, he says, Dekasha, v'chisal kadartach, do we think, shechazal yomru al akum, sheyesh lo tzelem elokim, kefishi beranu, sheyeh nechshav rak kebehema? What? A non-Jew, who the Mishnah is telling us has a tzelem elokim, as the form of God, whatever that means, is like an animal, so to speak, when it comes to hilchos tumah, that they you know, nothing void, like an animal, has no significance or consequence when it comes to tumah. It doesn't make sense. How could they have a tzelem elokim and not transfer tumah? Similarly, he says, the two deem kain, and furthermore, he says, ma zed de ka'amar kud shabrichu v'yisem lisagul mikol ha'amim. That you should be a segula, a treasure to me among all other nations. What should it really say? You should be a treasure among all other animals. Meaning to say, if it's true that the non-Jews have no tumah and they're considered like animals in this sort of framework, but I mean, we're playing devil's advocate here, just to, for those who want to take this recording out of context, right? So he says, Hashem shouldn't say Bikola Amim, it should say, Mikola, the way he says it is, Mikola Koifim Shedomim Bimetumunosam La'adam. He says, Hashem made us special from all the primates. It doesn't say that. Mikol ha'amim, as if the other nations have significance themselves. Similarly, he says what too? Dim ken yekol maase maase behema. If it's true that they have no tumah and they're considered that they don't transmit tumah, so then really the actions of 99.9% of the world's population is insignificant then, right? She'ena ba'aras schar v'onesh. They shouldn't therefore be receive reward or punishment. We know that those who do well, I mean, in the world around us, do wonderful, tremendous things around us, get Olam Haba. Huge shares in Olam Haba. Certainly those in Yad Vashem and more. There are many, 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 many good people out there who are not Jews. And we believe that they have Schar V'Onesh. How does this work? And then he goes on to list examples. So this to me was very fascinating. Let's try to work out these examples for a second. Take a look at the top of the page 6. V'anachnu ra'im, we see, kama me'achasidehem, shel milvad shemakirim yotzei bereishis, besides the fact that they recognize there's a creator, ma'aminim ba'Torah kadosh, they believe in the Torah, shei Elokis, that it is godly, v'oizim right, gvilas chasadim in Yisrael, they do good things with Jews. He says, v'kama me'ahem, sheitiv b'yotzei, l'kol ba'o ba'olam. Some of them have invented things which have really helped the world. So I want to just take a stab at this. Who do you think these people are? Look at the. I just emboldened the next few things. The names. Who is he quoting here? Who is he quoting as examples of people who have endowed the world with great things? fantastic! The first one is, he says, Kechosid Yanar, referring to Edward Jenner. What did Edward Jenner do? Vaccine for smallpox, right? He says, Shimtsi, now I'm not sure what that word is in German. He says, Shal Yodon Nitzolim Kama Revovos B'nei Od Mecholim Mimimochen. Right, so he says, Edward Jenner invented the smallpox vaccine. Right, just beforehand, just before when he's living. Another example, who's the next person? Francis Drake. By the way, I put all these people on the last page. Francis Drake was not only a discoverer and a navigator, but he brought the potato to Europe.
Kartoffel.
Right, the kartoffel, right? So now, what's the significance of the potato? Now, you know how many droughts there were? You know how many famines there were? The potato was the only thing which grew and saved millions of lives. Millions of lives. Why? Because of Francis Drake. Who's the next person? Gutenberg, right? Why? What did he give humanity?
Printing press,
right? So it's such a pleasure to read this, right? So says the Tiferes Yisrael. Look at the world around us. Look at what these people have contributed to humanity. You take a look at the larger paragraph at the top over here. He says, you see, some non-Jews who did such amazing things in this world, and they never got schar in olam hazeh. Example, he says, Kachosid Reichlin. There was a non-Jewish fellow called Reichlin. He says, "Shehara lemoves nafshoi laatzin sreifas hashisin shenitztava me'akezar Maximilian vishnas reish samach beis al yedei hasosas amumar." So, who was this Reichlin? So, I want to thank Dr. David Levy for he actually had a review on this on a book of the writings of Reichlin, which were actually put out in 2013 in German. He was a person called Johann Reichlin who lived, was born in 1455, lived to the 1522. Very interesting individual. He lived in Germany, and it was at this particular time there was a large debate between how to deal with the Jewish books. Are the Jewish books blasphemous? Do they need to be burnt? Do they need to be confiscated? How do you deal with this? So there was a fellow called Pfefferkorn who was particularly of the opinion backed by the Dominican friars at the time, who certainly were a big thorn in the side of the Jews for history, and certainly around this time in history, who suggested that all Jewish books, and specifically the Talmud, was always preventing them from converting to Christianity, and the only way to deal with it is to burn them and to confiscate them. So Reuchlin actually was commissioned by Maximilian, the king, who told him, please analyze the Jewish books and tell us if, you know, in fact they are blasphemous and what should the policy be. So he did a longitudinal study, and he divided them into 6 different sections of Jewish books, and he basically pointed out that the books that had things which, or sayings or statements against Christianity were very, very far and few in between, and in general, the ones that said it were generally not accepted by the Jews as mainstream as a whole. And therefore, he defended, unlike the rest of the researchers on his team, he defended Jewish books. And in fact, he was a Philo Semite. He himself wrote many writings and about discourse and dialogue between Christians and Jews, and be able to understand and appreciate Jewish thinkers, Bible thinkers, and scholars. scholars and Kabbalists, and the encouraging discussion. He was, because of his actions, because of his defense of the Jews, he was brought to court, and he was publicly ridiculed. In fact, papers were written against him. The paper he wrote in defense of himself in the year 1511 was confiscated, and he had to go to court in Rome. Ultimately, he was vindicated, but not after losing a large amount of his wealth and ridicule by the time that the public were no longer interested in hearing that, in fact, he was vindicated and defended. But this is the episode of Reuchlin, of Johann Reuchlin, who was a tremendous aid to the Jews and probably saved many thousands of Jews from persecution. Listen to the way that it's described over here in the Pharisees as well. He goes on to describe how this fellow saved these thousands of Jews and never, ever received recompense for it, and died in sorrow with a broken heart. He put himself on the railway tracks. He was able to retract the decree to kill the Jews at this particular time. And the priests persecuted this fellow, Reuchlin, to the degree that he died alone, brokenhearted. So he said, he didn't even get schar in olam hazeh. He says, you're going to tell me over here that what? There's no tumor that he's going to transfer because he's not an Adam, so to speak? This is what the Tiferes Yisrael asks. How does that work? Logically speaking. So the Tiferes Yisrael makes a suggestion, which remarkable, a very beautiful and creative suggestion. I think this is something which should carry us in our perspective of what we'll call global considerations. Here we are. I'm not going to read through it all because it's long and lengthy, but I will... But I do really advise that people take a chance to read through, in his own words, his suggestion. He says like this: look, when the Jews were in Egypt, when we were a substrate of Egyptian society, were we any different to the nations of the world around us?
No.
The answer is very little difference. I mean, we did have a patriarch called Abraham, but a lot of people learn from Abraham, right? And we had a patriarch and a matriarch, right? We had our leaders, but really at a certain point, besides for a little bit of an accent and names, right, we didn't have very much difference between the people we were living among and the nations around us. What happened is slowly HaKadosh Baruch Hu showed us the way. What did he do? So slowly he beat down the Egyptians around us. We learned about this a little while back, that there are two audiences to the Makos. The one audience was the Egyptians, and the one audience was the nation of Israel themselves. So slowly HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings us out, brings us to Yam Suf, and in case anybody was not unsure about God, at this point in time it became a little more evident. And then finally brings us 49 days later to Har Sinai, and he endows us with the truth. So he says, if that's true, that means to say that in a certain sense, we were given the fast track to getting to what God wants in this world, right? Meaning God told us explicitly what he wants from us. In fact, he told us that there's 613 explicit ways to get there, right? There's 365 no-nos and 248 yeses, and this is how you get to service of God. So he gave us the instruction manual to get there. If that's true, take a look at the bottom of page 6, the last paragraph. He says, "Aval loy kein shar ha'umos." That's not true with other nations. To after us, b'chol hazman ahu, shekarav HaKadosh Baruch Hu es Yisrael la'ashlamasam, even though he brought Israel to proximity and closeness of service, adayin hoyu kol ba'olam hoizim, they still remained captured in their, you know, we'll call it spirals of self-created morality. Any moral code or system that they arrived at, and we'll call it achievements in the moral plateau which they arrived at, self-made, because God didn't give them an instruction manual in the same way. Think about that. Think about the moral plane, or the moral incline which the world itself has climbed over the last 3,000 years. That's amazing, and that was self-achieved, right? They are more self-made than the Jews are, because the Jews were given explicit instructions, right? Right, means to say, if you think about this, when you look at both of us, he says, take a look at the top of the next page. He says, Nimtza, in the underline, Sheyes Yisrael ulo umos acheros, lekol echod mala levadis. Each group has its own mala, has its own, we'll call it, point of success. Hamala lumos al Yisrael, sheim bebechirosom achavshis, levekoach atzmum, mamish osu es atzmum. The non-Jews arrived at their moral area today, or their apex, through their own discovery and self-awareness. which the Jews didn't. However, jumping to the next emboldened place, there's only so far you can get when it comes to your own logic and moral systems and utilitarianism and Nietzsche, right? When it comes to Judaism, Judaism has given us certain things which are beyond human logic so we can get higher. But the only reason we could get higher is because we got the cheat sheet, right? That's the way he looks at it. If that's true, he says, what's the Torah really saying? What's the Gemara really saying in Rishon Bar Yochai? We'll come back to the original statement. Atem kriyim Adam, ve'ein ode kochavim kriyim Adam. You are called Adam, and the nations of the world are not considered Adam. This is very simple. If we go back, Adam isn't just the name of humanity. Adam is the name of the first human being who ever lived. If you think about that, Adam Arishon was a person who was created, self-made, given specific instructions by God, and had a very clear idea and purpose of what was going on in the world. So you are like Adam. I plucked you out of humanity, the rest of the nations, and I've told you what I want from you. I made it explicit. You are like him in that respect. Isn't that brilliant? And because you're like him in that respect, that means to say there's going to be certain things which you're going to be endowed with and restricted from and expected to do, which they aren't. That's your mana. But don't make any mistakes. When it comes to Ha'adam, humanity as a whole, as Rabbeinu Tam says, they're not chopped liver. They are their achievements are perhaps sometimes even greater than the Jews because they are routed by their own moral caliber. But that has limitations. That's what the Tiferes Yisrael says. Brilliant. But this is the way he looks at what is the Sashkavik Sugya, both in terms of Halacha and the perspective spiritually and rationally. I think this is something which I think the Jews need to learn a little bit out. Some of our communities are better at separation, and some of our communities are better at integration. Those who separate and talk about non-Jews in negative terms need to learn a little more about this Tiferes Yisrael. And those who integrate too much need to have a little more of a reminder that there is differences. In the meantime,